Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Les plateformes de réalité virtuelle comme Resil aident les sportifs amateurs et professionnels à affiner leurs compétences pendant qu'ils récupèrent d'une blessure. Cela les aide à retourner sur le terrain avec confiance. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 7th of March, these are our main stories. South Africa has petitioned the International Court of Justice to impose new emergency measures on Israel, citing what it describes as widespread starvation in Gaza. Ukraine's southern city of Odessa has been hit by a deadly missile strike during a visit by President Zelensky and the Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis. 1,000 National Guard soldiers and police officers are to be deployed to patrol New York City's subway to help tackle violent crime. Also in this podcast...
Of course, there is a certain curiosity as to what they would have thought of this, but they did not participate in this decision.
A new book is published by the sons of a late great Colombian author against the wishes of their parents. South Africa has asked the International Court of Justice to order emergency measures against Israel over its war in Gaza, warning that starvation for Palestinians must no longer a threat but a reality. This is the second time Pretoria has asked the court to take action in the war. In February, a call to order Israel to halt an offensive against the city of Rafah was denied. I got more from our correspondent in The Hague, Anna Holligan.
South Africa accuses Israel of repeatedly using humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip in negotiations, creating hostile, inoperable environments for aid agencies, blocking aid deliveries, creating restrictions and denials, closed crossings, deliberately targeting and killing humanitarian workers, and destroying Palestinian crops and arable land. I'm just reading through these here. Forcing Palestinian men, women and children to eat animal feed, bird seed and leaves. And of course, Israel has denied targeting humanitarian workers.
I mean, South Africa is a real leading voice in this. Does it have support?
There is widespread support. But what we've seen in this case over the last couple of months is how the kind of global community is divided, and we have seen Israel's allies like the US, of course, object to this case initially. But now, as the situation is changing, their positions have become more dynamic. And that's really putting the pressure on this court, actually, because more and more countries are seeing international justice as a means to wield real power on the ground. And this is one of the first situations in which they're dealing with an active conflict. This isn't international justice in retrospect. This is in real time. And so the pressure is on the court now. And just towards the end of this document, South Africa draws parallels with the situation in Bosnia in the 1990s, and points out that Bosnia came to the ICJ in 1993 and asked for a similar ruling to prevent genocide. That request was rejected, and in 1995, genocide was committed in Srebrenica. And what South Africa says just at the end of this submission is that the court must act now to prevent another genocide. But what the court has to weigh up now is whether the situation has changed enough since their original provisional measures were issued to justify issuing more, as South Africa has requested here.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. There's been another deadly Russian missile strike in the southern Ukrainian port city of Odessa, this time during a visit by the Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis. captured there the sound of the attack, which happened just a few hundred metres away from where Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was showing Mr. Mitsotakis around the port. No one from either delegation was hurt, but five people have died. I spoke to Vitaly Shevchenko, a Russia editor at BBC Monitoring, about what had happened.
They were at the port seeing the infrastructure when they heard sirens and explosions. According to Mr. Mitsotakis, they didn't really have time to take cover, and he described it as a very intense experience. Now, afterwards, President Zelensky described the attack, and he said, and I quote, that Russia had either gone crazy or lost control of its army. Now, we have to remember that Odessa has been under relentless Russian attack for more than a week now. The two leaders visited an apartment block which was hit by a Russian drone in the early hours of Saturday, and 12 people died, five of them children. So what happens is yet another attack on this really important Ukrainian city.
Given that, why do you think that the two leaders were there? It's a dangerous place to be.
It was an act of bravery, that's true. And President Zelensky has been on numerous visits to really dangerous places. And of course, no place within Ukraine is completely safe, but he's made a point of visiting frontline towns and villages just a few hundreds of meters away from Russian forces.
And of course, Russia has attacked places where they know foreign dignitaries are.
It has. In April 2022, Kyiv was bombed when the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was there, and the UN delegation said they were shocked by this act. And it would appear that this can be part of Russia's strategy: undeterred, unapologetic, and relentlessly targeting Ukrainian cities, regardless of who's there, foreign dignitaries or civilians or children.
And of course, the Russian Defense Ministry said it was targeting a maritime drone facility. Is that plausible?
It is plausible, but it may or may not be true, because Russia doesn't really have a track record of being completely truthful when it comes to these attacks. It's denied targeting civilian infrastructure consistently. And B, Ukraine doesn't reveal what's being targeted. In fact, it's an offense to disclose immediately after these attacks that such and such military facility or civilian facility has been targeted. So there's a shroud of secrecy surrounding these attacks, which is only to be expected at a time of war.
Vitaly Shevchenko. When Alan Scott went to work as a conductor on New York City's subway network last week, he hadn't expected it to be different from the past 24 years in the job. But that day, his neck was slashed in a violent attack, and he vowed he would never go on the underground again. It's one of many altercations and killings on the transport service recently, so the authorities have announced a new measure. They'll be sending 1,000 National Guard soldiers and state police officers on patrol there. The task force will check platforms and passengers' bags for weapons. Governor Kathy Hochul gave details at a news conference.
We're focusing on repeat offenders, deterring crime, and protecting the people on our subways, because no one heading to their job or to visit family or to go to a doctor appointment should worry that the person sitting next to them possesses a deadly weapon. They shouldn't worry about whether someone's going to brandish a knife or gun. That's what we're going to do at these checkpoints.
These subway users gave their thoughts.
I think it would kind of deter some things that have been happening. I've certainly noticed a difference in crime in subways that even have me as an NYPD employee fearful of my safety.
I think it's not a wonderful use of our resources to be putting National Guard into our subways. we should be providing those resources to supporting folks who are homeless, to our new immigrant families who are coming into the city.
I think it's worse than ever. It's been getting worse for the last couple of years. And since the ridership seems to still be down from COVID, you feel a little alone down there.
Subway users in New York City on new measures to tackle violent crime. It was described by one politician as an alleged act of vigilantism that instilled terror into young children. Now, police in Western Australia have called for calm after a video circulating on social media showed a 6-year-old girl and a 7-year-old boy with their hands tied, crying and cowering in terror in a driveway as a large man stands nearby. The children are from the Aboriginal community. The man is white. He's now been charged with aggravated assault. The Premier of Western Australia, Roger Cook, echoed the police call.
Anyone that saw that video would have found it confronting, would have found it disturbing. And I understand that it raises very strong emotions in everyone in the community. But I urge everyone, let the police get on and do their job. Let the justice process take place.
Our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer, spoke to Janat Jalil about the incident.
Well, the police say that this happened in the seaside town of Broome, which is about 2,000 kilometres to the north of Perth in Western Australia. They received one telephone call from a neighbour saying that there were children in a pool in a vacant property. They then received another call about 10 minutes later from a 45-year-old man who said that he had restrained three children for allegedly causing damage. Now, when the police officers reached the property, they found allegedly two Aboriginal children tied up with cable ties in the driveway of a house at Cable Beach, which is a very popular place for tourists in Broome. And the officers believe that a third Aboriginal child was also restrained but managed to escape. The children have been checked over by paramedics and reunited with their families.
And what's been the reaction in Australia to this?
Well, senior state officials in Western Australia say that they are appalled by some of the footage that has been shared on social media. Politicians say that the video was disturbing and confronting. So this will once again highlight the treatment of Aboriginal children in Australia when it comes to the criminal justice system. First Nations Australians aged between 10 and 17 are 29 times more likely to be in detention than their non-Indigenous counterparts. And of course, this alleged act of vigilantism doesn't concern the criminal justice system in terms of those children. But once again, this alleged incident does shine a light on the way that Aboriginal children are sometimes treated by the broader community.
Phil Mercer in Australia. We thought we'd close the final chapter on the work of Nobel Prize-winning author Gabriel Garcia Marquez when he died 10 years ago. But a new book, Until August, was released on Wednesday. The lost novel is being published by his sons, Gonzalo and Rodrigo Garcia Barcha, despite his request for it to be destroyed. Our culture reporter Yasmin Rufo has the story.
Would you go against the last wishes of your parents? Directly do something that they asked you not to do? Well, that's what Gonzalo and Rodrigo have done. They have published a novel he wrote over a decade ago while struggling with dementia. Gonzalo told the BBC he wasn't sure what to do with the novel at first, but destroying it was not an option.
Of course, we didn't destroy it. We weren't sure what we were going to do with it, but definitely destroying it was not in our plans. About a couple of years ago, 2022, we came back to the book and we didn't find it as disastrous as Gabo had judged it.
The book is also unique in that it's the first of Garcia's novels to center on a female protagonist. Until August tells the story of a middle-aged woman who travels alone to an island every summer to visit her mother's grave, and during each trip takes a new lover, despite being happily married.
We decided that maybe Gabo wasn't in a position to judge his work. You know, he He could only see the flaws.
The story, which is very different to some of his most beloved novels, such as 100 Years of Solitude, has received mixed reviews from critics, with one concluding that his family and publishers should have respected his wishes, as he was right to have never wanted this book to see the light of day. García Márquez's book is not the first novel to be published posthumously against the author's demands. The likes of Franz Kafka, Vladimir Nabokov and Virgil have all had works published after their death despite asking friends and family to burn their stories. Gonzalo told a press conference in Madrid that, of course, he wonders what his late father would have made of his decision.
Of course, there is a certain curiosity as to what they would have thought of this, of what we've put together now, but they did not participate in this decision.
However, he says that him and his brother are certain that they have made the right choice in publishing this novel.
We decided that, you know, we'd give it a shot at giving our version of what Gabo's work would look like. This is really Gabo's last work. There's nothing else in the drawer. This is the last thing that he was working on.
That report by Yasmin Rufo. Still to come on this podcast.
He was typical ordinary man, not a flying dragon breathing fire.
A film about a prominent Nazi gets its first screening in a former concentration camp.
As we mark International Women's Day, discover two podcasts from the BBC World Service celebrating women around the world. Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for season 3. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. In recent years, the Spanish authorities have investigated several top footballers on tax fraud accusations, with some cases resulting in millions of dollars in fines. Now, prosecutors are seeking a jail sentence of nearly 5 years for the Real Madrid manager Carlo Ancelotti over alleged undeclared earnings of more than $1 million. The newsroom's Nigel Adderley has more about the allegations.
They relate to his first spell in charge of the club in 2014 and 2015, and the Madrid Community Prosecutor's Office have accused him of creating a confusing and complex system of shell companies to hide extra earnings. Now, Ancelotti was paying tax on the wages he was getting from Real Madrid, his football club, but he was also earning money for the club as well for image rights, which are often negotiated separately to the core contract, and they relate to the image being used of the person in merchandise and promotion and that sort of thing. And the allegation is that this money was hidden away in these shell companies and tax wasn't paid on it. Now, there's been no comment from Ancelotti's legal team or the club so far, but the prosecutors in Spain believe they have a solid case.
So how extensive is the Spanish tax authorities' pursuit of footballers and top earners in sport?
Well, they've been going after celebrities as well as sports stars in Spain now over many years, because I think they became frustrated that a number of top sports stars and also in entertainment and other walks of life were being paid huge sums of money, but on large portions of that were not paying tax because it was being squirreled away into offshore tax companies. And we've seen two of the most famous footballers in the world also be prosecuted by the Spanish tax authorities. In 2017, Lionel Messi was given a 21-month jail sentence. That was reduced to a fine. He was found guilty of defrauding Spain of nearly $5 million during his time at Barcelona. And Cristiano Ronaldo also accepted a fine of over $20 million for tax evasion while he was playing at Real Madrid. And he was also given a 23-month jail sentence. But in Spain, convictions like that usually don't result in prison time, because a first-time offender who gets less than 2 years tend to spend time on probation or pay a fine. So effectively, Ronaldo's prison sentence was suspended. A number of sports stars have often blamed advisors previously and said that these companies were set up without really their knowledge. And although they were being paid the money, They weren't absolutely sure of where all the money was going and how much tax was being paid. But clearly, this doesn't wash with the authorities in Spain, and now they're cracking down hard once again.
The Newsroom's Nigel Adderley. In a few days' time, the Holocaust-era drama The Zone of Interest could make history by becoming the first British film ever to win the Oscar for Best International Feature. The film, which has five nominations, has become one of the most talked about of this awards season. The authorities at Auschwitz, where the film is set, recently held a special screening at the former concentration camp to mark the official Polish premiere. Our reporter, Tom Brook, was in the audience for the screening of A24's film, directed by Jonathan Glazer.
It has the feel of experimental cinema, an anthropological study of a man responsible for mass extermination, Rudolf Hirsch, the commandant of the Auschwitz concentration camp. It observes him, his family, and their domestic routines.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you.
The film's director, Jonathan Glazer, welcomed the audience to a special screening of The Zone of Interest in the cinema hall at the former concentration camp. It's Jonathan Glazer's first film in almost 10 years, a labour of love. He wanted authenticity. He wanted to shoot it at Auschwitz.
I felt that the film had to be about this place and the importance of this place.
But what really sets the director's film apart from standard Holocaust movies is its point of view. The focus is not on those who suffered at Auschwitz, but on the perpetrators. Chief among them, Rudolf Hirsch, the Nazi commandant of the camp, who lived with his family a seemingly blissful life in a house adjacent to the concentration camp. The audience at the special Auschwitz screening were impressed by the film's unusual perspective and how it normalised the horrific.
You can see ordinary people, like commandant of Auschwitz. He was typical, ordinary man, not a flying dragon breathing fire. He had family, his own life, and he was able to run the biggest death camp in Europe.
One of the things that's incredibly powerful is how he uses sound to convey the horror of the concentration camp. You hear the noises of Hirsch's children playing joyfully in the garden, combined with the suffering coming out of these buildings, people in pain, gunfire. The juxtaposition of these sounds is truly horrifying and very powerful cinema.
Director Jonathan Glazer.
To try and show these people as people, not as monsters, was a very important thing to do, because human beings did this to other human beings. And it's very convenient for us to try and distance ourselves from them because we think we could never behave this way. But I think we should be less certain in that.
That report by Tom Brook. A teacher in Bangladesh has now been formally suspended after shooting a student in the leg during an altercation at school and faces lifetime imprisonment if convicted. The incident caused outrage at the medical school in the city of Sirajganj. The teacher in question was already under review for erratic behaviour. Our Bangladesh correspondent Akbar Hossein has spoken to the school and told Stephanie Prentice about what they'd said.
They told me that there was an exam going on in a classroom, and the student, he was asked a question, and when he failed to answer that, the teacher, he became very furious. And at some point, he just took his revolver from his bag and shot him in his leg. And he received a very bad injury, and immediately he was taken to the hospital. And the other students, they became very scared, and they called the emergency helpline, 999, to the police. Then police came into the scene and they arrested the teacher.
And we know this teacher had previous, he had history of bringing weapons into the classroom. Why wasn't it addressed before? What have the schools said?
Basically, you know, in Bangladesh, you know, teachers are very powerful, so they can exercise their powers over students. The other students, they told me that arms are like a pet to him because he used to keep, you know, arms in his bag. You know, that was kind of his hobby. But they never filed any complaint. So that's why medical college authorities, they told me that they didn't know anything about it. But the behavior of the teacher, that was not up to the mark because that was not student friendly. That's why he was cautioned several times. And last month, he was given the final warning that the way he was behaving with the students, because he became furious and he is not attending his classes properly, and he is very rude to the students. That's why he was given the final warning.
And the police are looking into whether this gun was being held legally, because firearms are prohibited there.
Yeah, it is absolutely prohibited. I mean, if you want to have or keep any firearms in your possession, you have to have the permission from the police, because you have to show the reason that your life is at risk, your life is under threat. So two cases have been filed. The one is keeping illegal firearms in his possession, another is attempt to murder. So if they are proven before the court, he might be given lifetime imprisonment.
Akbar Hussain speaking to Stephanie Prentice. A statuette of the Virgin Mary in central Italy can cry tears of blood. So said a self-proclaimed visionary who drew large crowds to a small town north of Rome. Now that has been dismissed as fake by the Catholic Church after it launched an investigation into the phenomena last year, as Alice Adderley reports.
After an investigation involving theologians, members of the clergy and followers of the cult which sprang up around the statue, the Diocese of Civita Castellano near Rome has ruled there's nothing supernatural about it. Since 2016, Gisella Cardia had claimed it cried tears of blood and delivered a message to her direct from the Virgin Mary every third day. She'd been holding large prayer meetings in front of a shrine she'd created in the town of Trevignano Romana, much to the annoyance of locals.
Alice Adderley. And finally, K-pop star Karina has issued an apology to angry fans who accused her of betrayal because she has a boyfriend. The fans reportedly drove a truck to the singer's agency after finding out she was dating actor Lee Jae-uk. On the truck was an electronic billboard which said, "Is the love given to you by your fans not enough?" Correspondent Laura Kress spoke to Luke Jones.
Karina, as you said, she's the lead singer from this K-pop band, Aespa. She gave this apology on her Instagram Tuesday night, and that was a week after the news broke of this new love life. She started very solemnly. She said, "I'm sorry to have startled you." She went on saying, "I'm fully aware of how my MYs, or MYs, that's the name of the girl group's fan club, who have supported me, would have been disappointed in me to think of all the stories that we shared together." She then says, "I'd like to make amends for the hurt I've caused," saying she wants to heal the wounds and she wants to work harder to not let the fans down. But I think it's safe to say even this apology hasn't really calmed them down.
And is this whole issue at all surprising in the world of K-pop?
It isn't. It's not really surprising in the world of pop, I'd argue, either. But this is quite an extreme example, even in pop, and specifically in K-pop. Don't forget, it did used to be common practice for K-pop agencies to actually ban new stars from dating.
Yes.
Even having a personal mobile phone. And so now these admissions of romantic relationships, often quite scandalous even now to hear.
And is there any support for her from her fans?
It's in the minority, I have to say. Looking through social media reaction to this, a lot of people angry, actually, that she gave this apology on Instagram rather than something called Bubble, which is the private messaging service for fans, and they pay a monthly subscription fee for that. But I did find one message. They said, "You don't need to apologise for feeling. I'll always root for your happiness."
Laura Kress. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randell and the producer was Madeline Drury. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.